Hey, it's March 8th, 2024, and this is the Room Now podcast. Welcome, I'm Jack Cush, executive editor of RoomNow.com. Today on the podcast, a number of interesting items, some regulatory announcements, some MRI studies, CDC coming out with information about the incidence and prevalence of arthritis. We always need to keep that information in our back pocket. Let's begin with some approvals, and mainly biosimilar approvals. I think this is noteworthy. I think the top of the list would be Sandoz announcing FDA approval of two interchangeable biosimilars of denosumab. One is called Wyost, and the other one's called Jubanti, and these are meant to replace Prolia and Xgeva. I'm not aware of Xgeva, but it must be yet another version of denosumab. So these are going to be interchangeable at the local level, and I think that's great. We're going to drive down the cost of better bone health care. Another interesting and useful biosimilar is the second version of Actemra. This is a tocilizumab biosimilar made by Frensius Kabi. It's called Tyene, T-Y-E-N-N-E. And it is a little bit different than the other previously approved mid last year tocilizumab biosimilar. This one has both approval for the IV and the sub-Q formulation. So that'll be hopefully something that will improve health care and cost of care. Still's disease, as you know, I'm very interested in. I saw, there's a few meta-analyses out right now about either the review of Still's disease and its pathogenesis, pretty extensive one done by some Italian investigators. Another one's a meta-analysis showing that anakin or tocilizumab and canakinumab are good at remission rates and relieving steroid use. But they're limited because it's a meta-analysis and there really aren't that many studies. So this other report, I think, however, is important. I thought it was going to be about IL-1 and IL-6 inhibition, but and the incidence of macrophage activation syndrome. As you know, in Still's disease, the incidence is probably somewhere around 20 to 30%. This can be a really high mortality. It's probably the only thing that will kill someone with Still's disease. Either steroid use, inappropriate, too much, might kill by secondary complication. But Still's disease doesn't kill anybody. It's dramatic and all that. But if you develop macrophage activation syndrome, the outcomes can be really ugly. So this study, which looked at 162 kids and adults with Still's disease, and then looked at the subset of those that were on biologics, either IL-1 or IL-6 inhibitors, they found some interesting things. What they found was that those that were on biologics, as you would expect, they would have lower platelet counts, lower ferritin levels, lower CRPs, lower ESRs, and less fever duration. How low? Well, ferritin on a biologic was 1,100 versus off a biologic, 2,800. CRP on a biologic was 15 milligrams per liter. Maybe it's not. Well, it's 15 milligrams. I'm not sure the units. It could be deciliter versus 90 in those that are off. And what they showed that if you were on either an IL-1 or IL-6 inhibitor, 27% did not meet classification criteria for mass, which you don't use and I don't use generally, but they are out there and they were developed for a mainly mass associated with HLH related definitions, if you will. I thought this report was going to be the fact that if you're on an IL-1 or IL-6 inhibitor, could you develop macrophage activation? And the answer is yes. While treatment of macrophage activation syndrome is relieving the cause, starting steroids, starting an IL-1 or IL-6 inhibitor, there's a fairly low incidence of people on those drugs who will develop MAS. But now what we know is that if you're on those drugs and you develop MAS, it could be harder to diagnose, meaning because the absolute levels of the thing you hang your hat on, the ferritin, the CRP, the platelet counts, etc., may be lower than you expect. I thought so. Anyway, this is clinically useful information. Did you know that having obstructive sleep apnea may increase the odds of developing gout? What? A study of over 3.5 million patients, it's an EHR study, looked at those who had a BMI greater than 30. And in that group, there was a 23% of those people had sleep apnea. If you had sleep apnea, you had more than a twofold increased risk of developing gout, meaning with the sleep apnea, the incidence of gout was 7.2%. Without it, it was only 2.8%. So the odds ratio was somewhere between roughly 2 and 2.6, and that was significant. Now, how would you, you know, make that connection? Is this causal or casual? It's probably casual, right? Sleep apnea associated with obesity, obesity associated with a lot of metabolic syndrome. I think that's where this goes. But it doesn't hurt to consider your patients with sleep apnea as people who might be at risk for future gout. Why not? A report this week looks at the incidence of developing a rheumatic disease after gout. So autoimmune and rheumatic disease is a report from Annals of Internal Medicine. And it's a large multinational study of patients who had the SARS-CoV-2 infection and showed that those people had, and as has been reported before, an increased risk of developing an autoimmune or rheumatic disease. But that the interesting thing about this report was, well, besides it being in Annals of Internal Medicine, was that that risk extended out for a full 12 months after the infection. So I think that this is real. I think that, you know, SARS-CoV-2 can be a severe infection, can be an infection that can activate the inflammasome. It's a pathogen associated molecular pattern that, and that would be the spike protein that causes that, that activates the inflammasome. And then in people who might be otherwise predisposed or might have other environmental factors previously in play, they can develop other rheumatic diseases as has been reported in the past. But the interesting thing is it could go on for as long as a year after the infection. I posted a report because I'm not really familiar with the use of MRI in diagnosing idiopathic inflammatory myositis. And in this report, they looked at 85 patients who underwent MRI in the diagnosis or the attempted diagnosis of myositis. And they, what was interesting was that they showed associations between the MRI pattern or abnormal patterns that were seen and the clinical manifestations of myositis. So the clinical patterns that were seen were either a honeycomb pattern, a foggy pattern, or a dense dot pattern. If they found that honeycomb and foggy was associated with antibodies against TIF1 gamma and Mi2 and MSA negative dermato and polymyositis, also SRP signal recognition pattern positive people, and also those who have HMGCR antibodies. The honeycomb pattern was associated with an increased risk of cancer sixfold or Gottrin's eightfold. The foggy pattern was associated with an 11-fold increased risk of weakness, and a dense dot pattern was associated with a sixfold increase of dysphagia and then some other number, lower number for cancer or neoplasia. And I look at this and go, I'm still not doing MRIs to diagnose myositis. Never had to. I think in my career, I think I've got two, and they were tests done by someone else, and they, at best, they were supportive. I can think of two cases where I actually ordered it, and it was negative, and people had florid myositis. So I think it's a useful tool. It, you know, basically, it shows muscle edema, and the edema and water signal, T2 signal, is related to inflammation, and voila. I still would like to hang my hat, as we talked about last podcast or podcast before, about the utility of insertional activity in diagnosing inflammatory myositis, insertional activity on EMG and nerve conduction studies. I don't think that this is enough. Dense dot, I don't even know what that means, but I'm going to ask about whether they can swallow or not. Weakness and a foggy pattern, isn't that why I'm evaluating the patient? They got weakness. And then the autoantibodies, I think we're now, a lot of us are using and whatnot. HMGCR is a test you only use if you're looking at, I think, for statin-associated myositis or someone has necrotizing myositis. And there are a lot of different causes of that. So anyway, give me your bias. Do you think I should be ordering MRIs? You're really going to have to work to convince me. Another study on the antisynthetase antibody profile. This is a study of 701 patients with either anti-JO, PL7, PL12, or EJ antibodies. And they subjected this cohort to machine learning to see if they could subset the patients. And basically, they identified three endotypes, which are profiles that determine phenotypes, that are independent of the autoantibody specificity. So since this is a study of antisynthetase antibodies, it's not surprising that 62%, this is pattern three, had an association with arthritis and mechanics hands and a good prognosis. And again, these are all myositis patients. The lesser subsets was the number one subset, was at least the first subset, was those who had a rapidly progressive ILD and a high risk of mortality. Okay? Now, you don't know if they had, you know, the MDA5 antibody or other things that might be associated with that higher risk of rapidly progressive ILD. It is seen, by the way, in antisynthetase, more with MDA5. But I find that surprising. It puts a bigger number on that subset than I thought, 24%, if I'm just going by antisynthetase antibody profiling. The second or last subset was 14%, and these are people who are going to have dermatomyositis and basically an intermediate prognosis. So I like this kind of machine learning to give you clinical endotypes that can help you structure some of your thinking about patients that are newly presenting. What's the risk of developing axial spondyloarthritis if you start out with non-radiographic axial SPA? Dennis Podubny and others have published, I think, around a 15 to 19% risk. The DeSeer study, which is a prospective cohort of new onset SPA patients, they've got over, I think they have, you know, 500 or 600 patients. And they basically follow people with x-rays over 10 years. And in 294 patients, they had 10-year data. And they showed that the progression rate was 5.8%. And who was more likely to progress? Those who had bone marrow edema and sacroiliac joint. Those who were, and that was a six-fold increase. Those who were male, those who had symptoms going on for more than a year and a half, those who had active disease with ASDAS greater than 2, and those who were smoking, but that only applied, the latter only applied to those who are B27 positive. So this is a lower number, but is this more true than that reported previously? That's, it was over 15%? Let's just say that the risk of progression from non-radiographic to radiographic SPA, or AS, is probably between 5 and 15%. Another cross-sectional study of over 500 patients with axial spondyloarthritis, and these patients were taking biologics, found that some of them had not IBD. We previously reported that number, I think, was around, I want to say, 4 to 8% when all was said and done. In this study, they looked at the number who had irritable bowel syndrome, not IBD, IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. The number is 25%. And you can kind of guess what the profile of that SPA patient might be. And I'm not making judgments here, but they were more likely to have fibromyalgia, anxiety, depression, be female, unemployed, have a higher BASFI and BASDI score, and more likely to have seen prior multiple biologics and have lower physical activity. So there's hints there, right, of the phenotype for irritable bowel syndrome, don't be confused and think it might be IBD. You probably still should nonetheless either refer or get an imaging study. I did a Twitter poll this week about interviews. Got into a discussion with some colleagues. You know, all interviews now for rheumatology fellowship, for medical school, for jobs, they're all virtual. They're almost never face-to-face. So I asked the question, I said, basically, it's a whole new world out there regarding interviews. For jobs, residency, fellowships, what's your interview preference? And the options were face-to-face, live, virtual and Zoom, telephone and none. Well, most of you, 50%, said you preferred a face-to-face interview. 38% said a virtual was okay. 12% said none. The bottom line is 100% of you are likely to do your interview with virtual, which was your least, well, the lesser of the two between face-to-face and virtual. My point being is you got to practice. You know, interviews are hard enough, but doing them virtually is even harder, meaning you have to have the right equipment. You have to be prepared on how to handle questions when it seems so nameless, faceless, and whatnot. I'm going to do, I think, a series of videos on this. Watch for that in the future. Two more reports, an increased risk of depression in RA. This is a very large Korean study where they think they looked at over 38,000 people with a 1 to 5 comparison with an age, sex, and matched cohort. And they had a 4-year follow-up, and they found RA patients had a 66% higher risk of depression compared to controls. That's a hazard ratio of 1.66. By the way, it didn't matter if you were seropositive or seronegative. And also, if you were treated with either a biologic or a JAK inhibitor, you had a lower depression risk at 1.33 hazard ratio. So you're going to lower your risk if you get under more effective control. But RA in itself carries, I think, a substantial risk of depression. And depression, by the way, with RA, my goodness, it screws up drug responses. It magnifies morbidity and mortality. Yes, mortality is higher in RA patients who also have depression. It is incumbent upon us as the clinicians who know RA the best to probably be looking for depression. You should be doing the PHQ-9. It's a 9-question survey. They can do it in the waiting room, and you can identify these people early on and then either refer them or start treatment. Lastly, the CDC reported this week its updated prevalence of arthritis in the United States in adults. It's now 19%. Previously, that number was about 21%, which amounted to 53 million people in the United States with diagnosed arthritis. Now the number is 19% based on the 2022 National Health Interview Survey. The numbers were higher in women, 21.5%. More so than men, was 16%. So arthritis risk increased with age from 3.6% up to age 34 to 54% in those over age 75. Arthritis is higher in certain groups. Blacks, black, white, non-Hispanics, multi-race, were more likely to have it than Hispanic and Asians. Arthritis prevalence increased with increasing income, and arthritis prevalence increased with by region, but was decreased in urban areas. So it's more likely to be seen in rural areas. Again, statewide, there was quite a variety. You look at the CDC report to see what it's like in your state. Anyway, that's it for the podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Tell your friends, give us a good rating on iTunes. We'll see you next week here on the podcast. Bye now.